This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Massimo Vignelli about his favorite typeface, his fight against vulgarity and meaningless design, and what he means by forceful design.
Design that is emotionally charged, that has intensity on whatever it does. You know, it's not only harmony, but it's provocative at the same time.
Here's Debbie Millman.
Massimo Vignelli is one of the great design artisans of our time. He has worked on everything from package design and signage to furniture, interior design, and subway maps. He co-founded Vignelli Associates with his wife, Layla, and clients have included American Airlines, the New York Subway, St. Peter's Church, and many others. Vignelli has said, "If you can design one thing, you can design everything." Welcome to Design Matters, Massimo.
Debbie, it's my pleasure.
So you began your training as a 16-year-old draftsman at the Architects Castiglione in Milano.
Yeah.
There you were taught the axiom of Adolf Loos that an architect should be able to design everything from the spoon to the city.
Yep.
I understand that it was at that point in your life that you decided that you wanted to design everything and first stated that if you can design one thing, you can design everything.
Right.
So tell me more about that time and what you meant specifically about that statement.
Well, I said, if you can design one thing, you can design everything, because the discipline of design is the same. Once you have a discipline on your hands, on your mind, you can design anything. It's just a specific might change, you know. So if you can design graphics, you can design furniture. Same discipline. You know, I've designed tables that look like a Bodoni.
Now, why am I not surprised about that? You know, there are quite a lot of theories about your work and the way that you work. And there's something that I want to ask you about to see if it's true or if they are more urban myths. And, of course, one has to do with Bodoni. Is it true that you only use four typefaces, Garamond, Bodoni, Century Expanded, and Helvetica?
Yeah.
and so that's...
Well,
and
it's true, I tell you. It's very simple. People sometimes are surprised, but they forget that basically there are two kind of types, serif type and sans-serif type. So on the serif type, you have Garamond, which is 500 years old. You have Bodoni, which is 200, 300 years old. And, there are things like Caslon, like Baskerville. They're very dignified type, but I don't use all the time because they're basically very similar to the other two, which are much better. When you get to sans-serif type, you know, there is Futura, there is Accidents, which then became Helvetica, much better, and then is Universe, which is a much larger family. So usually it's between one of the three. So according to what we do, really it's true that we don't use more than half a dozen typefaces, but sometimes we use some others. You know, we're not fundamentalist in that respect, you know. But there are times that we might use a fancy type, too. You know, it depends on what you have to do. But most of the time, we don't have to fancy things to do. So that's why it limits also the use of typefaces, you know. If we had to do a newspaper, we certainly would look like in what is available today, for instance, for better legibility and the right impact and the elegance that we like to convey, whatever it is. And we're open, we're not closed, you know, to anything. It just so happens that most of the type is junk. And since it's junk, we trash it out.
Now, how do you define junk?
Something which is trendy, which is not lasting value, something which is just phony, something which is insensitive in the details, something which is not elegant, something which is not strong. All things which for us are quite important, you know. And so we just trash it. I mean, we don't use it. Well, this is not to discourage type designers. I mean, the challenge of coming out with the super-duper type is still alive, you know. It's going to be either a serif or a sans-serif. But it's funny that what we see around very often is not satisfactory as the great typefaces which have resisted for hundreds of years, like Garamond and Bodoni. Bodoni is the best one.
You said that you don't like to use type as a decorative element and that you're horrified, and you specifically use the word horrified, that you're horrified by any type deformation.
Oh, yes.
So what do you consider to be type deformation?
Well, anything which is just a deviation from a canonic type. You know, if you take Caslon and you begin to move it around, or, you know, or you take Clarendon, and Clarendon is quite good typeface, but very much connected in my mind with the Industrial Revolution, England, 1830, 1880, you know. So if I have, very English, great for pubs. If you have to do a sign for a pub in a great British tradition, Clarendon is perfect. But if you take Clarendon and you start to make a square rather than round or whatever it is, you know, doing this little thing that a lot of type designers, you know, there are very, very few great type designers, you know, just like there are very few great everything.
Would you consider to be a great type designer working
Frutiger,
today?
Frutiger, by all means, still alive. Herman Zoff, Frutiger. Matthew Carter is a very good one, too. And then there are some good, less important than that, less big than that, as names in Holland, in the Netherlands. There are some very good type designers, because Netherlands is always very been very attentive to this kind of issue.
Why do you think so?
Their tradition, you know, their tradition is very minute. They don't do big paintings. They do Vermeers.
The last time we spoke about typography, you said that you felt that at the time most typefaces were designed for commercial reasons,
yeah,
just to make money,
yeah,
and or for identity purposes. And I'm wondering if you still feel that way. Do you feel like there's been any improvement?
No, situation was still pretty much the same. As I say, it's one way to make a living, so you can't really discard that. I mean, we will have that around forever. You know, somebody that doesn't have enough culture or enough refinement in his creative mind, you know, it's possible that will not be happy with just a few typefaces, and he wants to do his own, not knowing that it's meaningless.
I want to talk about vulgarity.
Well, that's exactly part of it. This is why he doesn't know, because, well, you know, I think my one of my major tasks in life, you know, was to fight as much as possible vulgarity, not to wipe it out, but at least to reduce it.
Do you think that that's possible? Do you feel like you've been successful?
I think that not, of course, not a single man operation, but I think that in the last 40 years, 50 years, a lot has been done to improve the situation. I remember when I came to New York, it was a very ugly, dirty kind of city. Today it's beautiful, it's clean, it's a beautiful building. There was no architecture at that time, almost modern architecture. Now it's full of modern architecture. All the big architects are doing things here. There is full of very good designers. There are thousands of good graphic designers around. There was nobody at that time, which was very good for me.
I
was lucky. But, you know, it would be for me very difficult to emerge today, you know, because there is so much good designers, so much good design around.
Do you feel that the quality of clients has fundamentally changed in the 50 years you've been practicing?
Yeah, you know, it's very funny that really what happened. In the old times, I can say that.
The old times.
In the old times, there were very few good clients, and most of the people were not aware. Today, there are a lot of young people in the companies that they think they know everything. The reality is that they don't. But they're very adamant, and they're very commercial. They're very... they're not open, they're not intelligent, they're not cultured enough, basically. They might be intelligent, but they're not cultured enough. And therefore, the communication becomes very difficult because they articulate their wants rather than their needs. And there is a big difference, particularly marketing people, you know, which are the culprit of everything which is wrong, you know.
Yes.
And You know, marketing people, they're trained by bad education in marketing to satisfy wants instead of needs. And that is the key thing.
Well, you've talked quite a lot about this very passionately in your book, The Vignelli Canon, which is right now free on your website, but also coming out
in the printed version
in the coming months.
Yeah, well, in a month published by Lars Müller, you know, the Swiss designer, which pleases me to no end, you know, in a sense. It pleases even more that it's online because it could be read by millions of people. And instead, when a printed version could be read only by a few thousands, which is, you know, irrelevant. However, I got a very funny thing. I got an email the other day from some Russian friends that they translated the whole canon in Russian.
Really?
And they sent me the online version, which is very funny because it's all in Cyrillic and I don't understand a word.
But it must be gorgeous.
Same layout, exactly the same type, everything, you know.
Now, what made you decide to give away the Vignelli canon for free on your website?
I think that, you know, this kind of subject should be online. So it pleases me very much that it goes around the world. I wasn't certainly expecting that kind of a response, you know. In the first month, we had 300,000 clicks, you know, and I couldn't believe it. I said, 300,000? What they're doing with it? But then I got all the email of people saying it's great and student, you know, spreading it around and so on and so forth. So I say, well, I didn't know that it's such a good thing.
So is this the first time your work has been so intertwined with technology?
Yes. It is the first. I hope it's not going to be the last one because I really like that. You know, I do like the printed word as well, you know, because it's there. You don't need electricity to read a book. You know?
Yeah, you never have to worry about a battery running out.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but it's very cumbersome. Now, look what you can do now with the tablet. I mean, you go around, you know, with any one of those Amazon things, what is the name?
Kindle.
Kindle. And you have a library that never ends with just one little thing. If you're going to put all the books in the bag, you couldn't move.
It's an interesting concept, though. I'm surprised to hear you say that. I would have expected that you would not be a fan of the Kindle because of the possibility that it could replace the printed
contrary,
page.
I'm a great fan of the digital books. You know, I think we are in the infancy of that. I think that pretty soon we will have already the tablet probably is a size that allows a book or a magazine to be seen as a spread. But think the greatest thing about that, you're reading a book, instead of just a picture of a building, you go inside the building. Wow, what an architectural book that could be. It's the real architectural book. You know, and all this becomes very possible now. You turn the page, it becomes three-dimensional, the whole thing. I mean, it's mind-boggling. This is all going to happen. Too late for me, but what a great world for the future generations. You know, it's great.
Do you worry at all about the elimination of the printed page in any way, or do you feel that they can coexist?
No, I think the good things will have permanence. So good books will probably stay, you know, as a printed form.
Do you do a lot of design work on the computer or with the computer?
No, I still use my pencil for everything. You know, it's faster for me than a computer. I use the computer for writing, and that is fantastic. For design, no, I have to rely on people in my office that can do that, you know. I cannot do it.
Does that bother you, or
yes,
do you,
yes,
it does?
It bothers me a lot to depend, you know, for these things, because my language has been reduced a little bigger, a little smaller, a little more to the left, a little more to the right.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's a big reduction of language, in a sense. Now, all that, if I can do it myself, of course, would be much better. I envy all the young people that can do this like writing, you know, in a sense.
It's magical.
Yeah. Now, you know, I remember when I was 6 years old, you know, it was a big thing to learn how to write, you know. 6 years old today can write on the computer.
Effortlessly.
And do all kind of things, not just write. You can use the whole computer.
I want to go back to talking a little bit about your feeling that marketing managers' involvement with design is not always a positive thing. And you said in your book that we see design that has no meaning, stripes and swash of color splashed across pages for no reason whatsoever. Well, they're either meaningless or incredibly vulgar or criminal when done on purpose. Unfortunately, there are designers and marketing people who intentionally look down on the consumer with the notion that vulgarity has a definite appeal to the masses, and therefore they supply the market with a continuous flow of crude and vulgar design. I consider this criminal, since producing visual pollution that is degrading our environment is just like all other types of pollution.
I love to hear you reading it. It sounds even better. Sure, I believe very strongly about that, and I really think it's a crime. It's a word that I use intentionally because I think, you know, killing culture is no less of a crime than killing people, you know, because it kills their mind
and their spirit.
But of course, if we would have to put in prison people that do this kind of crime, the world would be too small as a prison, you know.
A design prison. They have to look at bad design all day as their punishment.
But it's true. The marketing people look down to people. Instead, I mean, a good designer or a good responsible client looks up to people. He understands his function of contributing, taking people out from those low levels and getting them to a better level. Just like when you give a good book to a person so they will not have the time to read a bad book, in a sense, you know. And that is the operation. One has to believe, of course, you know, in this redeeming factor of education, you know, a redeeming factor of not spreading vulgarity, because that lowers the level. The more you spread, the more the level goes down. And instead, our operation as designers and architects is to raise that situation, you know, so that the world might get a little better place, you know, and increase the good values, you know. Make a better food instead of a junky food, you know. It's part of this same idea. Making good music instead of a bad music is part of the same concept. There's making good design instead of bad design, instead of commercial design. There's commercial music, there's commercial design, there's commercial fashion, there's commercial everything, you know. Commercial things are done by people that want to exploit other people and couldn't care less about quality. We are interested with quality. This is what is nice. Nobility is our life. Isn't that great?
It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. Why do you think that vulgarity is so much easier for people to absorb than culture?
Because it doesn't require culture, exactly. It's easier because it doesn't require education. It doesn't require refinement, brain refinement. So therefore, it's so much easier, you know, to like things if you don't know. The moment you begin to know, knowledge brings you sifting ability. So you begin to sift the good from the bad. You know, the more you know, the more sophisticated you become, the more refined your taste becomes, and so on and so forth. So that is the task. It is to sift the trash out.
Now, you've said that you believe that design should be forceful and that you do not like limpy design. So how do you define limpy design? How do you define forceful design? How do you define limpy design?
I define forceful design a design that is emotionally charged, that it has intensity on whatever it does, you know, so that it's not only harmony, but is provocative at the same time, where the balance between the elements is exciting, the black and the white space. I mean, the printed and the emptiness, you know, are in a proper contrast, where the color works in that respect. And all that works with a good sense of appropriateness. So it's great for that situation, you know. I don't like limpy design, you know, the kind of, I used to say, the kind of nuns like to do, you know.
No. I wish that our listeners could see the little hand motions you're making right now to define limpy.
You know, and And yet, you know, those angel pure, weak kind of design, basically, you know, pale colors, meaningless stripes and meaningless things. You
so,
know,
so what is meaningless? How do, is it decorative? Is it there for the sake of being there?
Yeah, anything which is not pertinent and to a situation. But again, it depends on the object and the situation. I have nothing against decoration. Decoration could be very good, you know, but there are ways and ways of achieving. We achieve decoration by subtraction, because the subtraction is our methodology of working. Other people achieve decoration by addition. They keep adding. They do something. They do a plate, and then they put the flowers on top. Why do you put the flowers on top? Why don't you design a beautiful plate where, by just by looking at the plate, you say, oh, how handsome that plate is, you know? We have done a plate, for instance, and then we took off the glaze from the edge and revealed the material. And it looks terrific, you know? And so it is a decorative element. There was no need structurally, there is no need for anything else. Why we did it? Because it adds something by subtracting.
I want to talk a little bit about logo design and corporate identity. Mm-hmm. Today, United Airlines revealed their new identity after their merge with Continental Airlines. And their new identity is a bit of a mashup of the United name and the Continental mark. And you have very strong opinions, as we would expect, of identity design. You've said that perhaps because you grew up in a country where history and vernacular architecture were part of the culture of the territory and was protected, I consider it established logos something to be equally protected. A logo gradually becomes part of our collective culture. In its modest way, it becomes part of all of us. So what do you think of the way that identity design is approached now? We have two giant airlines, United Airlines, Continental. United has a mark and a name. Mm-hmm. Continental has a mark and a name. And now the merger of the companies is, let's take one of the marks and one of the names and mash it up together.
That's marketing. These are the solutions brought forward by marketing people, which have no imagination whatsoever. As a general category, I despise them. But there might be some great marketing men here and there, but as a category, I really despise them. They are the master of this kind of thing. They are mongrels. You know, they make this kind of a mix which has no creative solution whatsoever. Sometimes the solution is very easy. I mean, when Ciba and Geigy, the two gigantic pharmaceutical companies, got together, they called me to see what to do with their logo. And then at the end, I said, listen, Ciba has a great image. Geigy has a great image. Why do you want to destroy all this with a new logo? Call it Ciba Geigy. And they went on for many years until some stupid marketing guy came around and says, we need a new name. And that's when Novartis came about.
Oh.
Novartis? I mean, it's ridiculous, not even good for a paint, you know. And you give it to the two most dignified or very dignified pharmaceutical companies. You see, this is the typical thing that I despise, that kind of mind, you know. Same as United Continental, two great airlines. What's wrong about writing United Continental? I don't know. One of these days we're going to see Continited.
As long as they don't touch American, right?
Yeah, exactly. Thank God. You see, American Airlines, I can't believe it that it survived so long. But it's so damn good that it's no surprise. You know, so I hope they will survive for a long time, too.
Have you seen the new American terminal at JFK?
Yeah, I guess so.
Because they have a big, giant wall of the evolution of the logo over the years. It's brand new, and it's really magnificent. And I was thinking about you when I saw it, to see how well your mark has stood the test of time. So in 1971, you founded Vignelli Associates mm-hmm. with your wife. Mm-hmm. And in 2008, you donated the entire archive of your design work to the Rochester Institute of Technology. Mm-hmm. And the archive is going to be exhibited in a building that you have designed called the Vignelli Center for Design Studies. And it will include, among its many offerings, exhibition spaces, classrooms, offices, and it's about to open. Yeah. So tell us about how this all came to be. Congratulations. It's so exciting.
Well, thank you. It is exciting. It's very exciting. It all started back in 1979 when a professor from RIT came to visit us to ask what should be the education of design for the next 10 years at that time. And I said, well, enough with the Bauhaus Frobelian Games, and let's concentrate the education on history, theory, and criticism, which are extremely important and fundamental for the education of a designer. A designer without a sense of history is worth nothing. And if you don't have a theory, you don't know where you stand. You know, and criticism is what brings you about the whole thing. So 2 years later, they did the first international conference on history, theory, and criticism. And of course, I was the keynote speaker. It goes without saying. And then they start to collect archives from American modernists, you know, great names from Lester Beale to Will Burton, from C.B. Penelas to Leo Leoni, and so many others, you know, a lot of them. And they use these archives every day, basically, for teaching. So they don't get the archive put on the basement. No, they are in a place which is reachable by the teachers and the students. And so I like very much that. So we decided to give the whole thing to RIT.
How lucky for them.
And our archive is much bigger than any other one because we have a lot of three-dimensional things. We have studies and we have, you know, graphic works and tons of books. As a matter of fact, 650 boxes was in the latest move, you know. And so they build a building connected to the school and so on. So it's like an appendix of the school. And we design two cubes, one of brick, which is the archive area, and one of glass, which is the exhibition areas, basically exhibition and class, you know. So beside the archive, the center will have also a master on history, theory, and criticism for people that want to become teacher on that section and that, in those issues. I mean, as you say. And that I'm very, very, very happy because it goes more than just having an archive. There is a chair, it's called the Vignelli chair, the Massimo Vignelli chair for design. And now it's amazing. The amazing thing to me is that this happens in Rochester rather than New York. I mean, why not in New York? Of course we wanted to have it in New York because it would be more convenient for us. But it was impossible to find a place. It was impossible to find a school that would do this, you know, that create, you know, an entity, not just a basement full of boxes, you know. By the way, you should see how the new building over at the RIT, they have all these shelves, movable shelves, you know.
Really?
Yeah, they have air conditioning, they have humidity control, you have camera supervising the whole thing. So incredible, you know, state of the arts on that kind of issue.
You and your work will be able to live forever.
Let's hope.
We've come to the end of our broadcast today. I'd like to thank the magnificent Massimo Vignelli for joining me today.
Thank you, Debbie.
Over the course of the interview, we talked about the Vignelli Canon, which can be downloaded for free from vignelli.com, and a printed version will be available next month.
With more entries, by the way.
With more entries, with more wonderful new material. I'd like to thank you for listening, and remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I am Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.